Well, folks, welcome to the first of our Questions for Life events. We have Professor John Wyatt joining us this afternoon. We've got events happening all over the run-up to Easter. So there's details in the chat there for more events. And if you're wanting to kind of ask a question today, then please do head over to slido.com and use the code QFL. And that way we can vote on questions, and the most popular questions rise to the top, and they can be answered the most efficiently there. Professor John Wyatt, thank you so much for joining us today. Would you like to just perhaps begin with telling us, calling you a professor, what are you a professor in? What does that mean? And how long have you been doing that?
Yes, thanks. No, it's good to be here. I'm officially a professor in neonatal pediatrics, ethics and perinatology. It's all long, long words. Basically, I'm a baby doctor. I spent most of my life working as a baby doctor, caring for incredibly sick and some very, very premature babies in a big intensive care unit in central London. And then I became increasingly interested in ethical issues, medical ethics, and ethical issues created by advances in technology. So I've now retired from the front line, medically speaking. Haven't been called back from coronavirus because I think I was decided as thought to be worse than useless as a baby doctor. But I'm still very much involved in the debates about ethics and technology.
Great. And so you're officially in the retired status. Well, how do you feel your days if you're no longer a baby doctor?
Yeah, well, it's been a weird experience for me, as it has for so many people, hasn't it, in the lockdown. What I have had is lots of contacts with health professionals, both here in the UK. I'm closely linked in with the Christian Medical Fellowship, which unites lots of medics and health professionals working in the UK, but also with international medical work. And so I've been involved with webinars and seminars and conferences and debates and discussions with doctors around the world. And it's been astonishing how well the technology has been working and, you know, the opportunities for seeing what's happening with coronavirus and trying to support people working on the front line across the world.
Great. And in terms of you're not only a scientist, a doctor, a researcher, professor, and ethicist, you're also a Christian. Would you mind telling us a bit about how you became a Christian and kind of what that means and how it's impacted your field?
Yeah, I was brought up in a Christian family, but I always had the worry that I was being brainwashed by my parents. And when I eventually left home and went to university, it was a chance to try and work things out for myself. I wanted to be a scientist and went through a period of really sort of wrestling and asking questions and challenging. But it was in my first year at university, I really became convinced that it was possible to be Christian and a scientist and use my mind at the same time. And so I really, at that point, I became a Christian and discovered that Jesus was not just a historical figure, but a real person who I could relate to. And then quite rapidly after that, I got this strong sense of call to become a doctor. So actually, I finished doing physics. I changed my course and became a doctor. So the whole process of going into medicine was really part of a desire of maybe using the science that I was good at with the people that God really cared about.
And you're going to be speaking on hope for fragile minds and about mental health for us in just a minute. But certainly in the medical profession, it's certainly a profession that needs a lot of hope. And we've seen that over the past year immensely so, and I'm sure that's been no different to throughout your years in the medical profession. How was it that knowing Jesus provided hope just for the day-to-day, and what impact did that have for you?
Yeah, well, I mean, working as a doctor, especially in a sort of frontline specialty like neonatology, it's very demanding and challenging. And, you know, the years I've been confronted with so many tragedies, inexplicable events, and seeing human suffering and dying babies and so on. So the question of how you make sense of it all for anybody is a real challenge, and certainly for me as a Christian. But what I have found is that through trying to see Christianity as a way of showing meaning and purpose in even the most painful and challenging situations. So and amazingly, what I've discovered is that you know, God isn't necessarily most evident in churches. I mean, sometimes he is, but often it seems that in religious places, God can seem very distant. And astonishingly, what I've seen is the presence of God and God's presence working in an intensive care unit in a completely secular hospital. But God is present sometimes when we're at our most areas of most extreme need.
Great. Thank you. Well, you're here to speak to us today on mental health and hope for our fragile minds. So I'll hand over to you. I'll remind everyone that they can go to slido.com and ask questions. You're going to speak for about 15 minutes and take questions. So do head over there. If you've got questions that you'd like to submit, the code for slido.com is code QFL. So Questions for Life, QFL, and that'll take you to our event page. Thank you very much, John.
Yeah, well, thanks again for this opportunity to speak. So as I said, I'm a medic, but I'm not a psychiatrist. And actually, the reason I'm speaking about mental health issues is not necessarily from my medical professional opinion, but basically as a psychiatric patient. And I'm going to talk a bit about my own experiences of mental health issues. But to begin with, I just want to talk a bit about the coronavirus pandemic and the way that this has brought issues of mental health so much to the fore for many of us. And like so many people, I've been deeply personally affected by the coronavirus pandemic. A very close friend of mine, Peter Hart, was a paramedic working in South London. And he was infected by the coronavirus very early on in the pandemic. He was admitted to his own hospital. He spent weeks in ITU. There was fervent prayer for him from hundreds of people around the world, but then he died. And there's still not been possible to have any proper funeral service or celebration of his life. And that same story has been repeated thousands of times, as we all know. And I'm sure many people on this call will have been affected in some way. There are grieving families, loved ones, no chance to say goodbye, sometimes feelings of guilt and failure. 850 healthcare workers have died in the UK. It's one of the highest numbers of any countries apart from Mexico and the USA. And I know there are also many health workers who are traumatized by what they've experienced with PTSD, depression, anxiety, burnout. And I'm conscious that, you know, many people listening to this have been affected, and you may be struggling with long-term health issues because of the infection. You may be worrying about whether you're still going to have a job or how your children are going to get educated. And lots of studies have shown high levels of anxiety and fear in the general population. And it sometimes seems like fear is stalking our streets. It's on our TV screens as the daily infection counts are announced. It's on social media. It's in our homes as we worry about whether we might have become infected, whether we might pass the virus on to loved ones. And you could argue that fueling fear has been government policy. You know, stay at home saves lives translates into stay at home or you will die or you will kill someone you love. And fueling fear was seen by the government and health officials as an essential means of reducing the death toll. And it seems in some ways that fear worked by encouraging people to follow the lockdown. But you know, once you've raised those terrible fears, once those horrifying images of mass graves or rows of unconscious bodies in ITUs or stretchers with body bags, once those images have been imprinted on our minds, they're not so easy to erase. And psychiatrists and counsellors call this death anxiety, for many of us, the effect of the coronavirus pandemic has been to bring out those deepest fears about our own mortality, which have been suppressed and buried. And those fears, which we try so often to keep damped down, that have come out. You know, normally we go to extraordinary lengths to suppress the truth that we're going to die from our consciousness, and we develop psychological defense mechanisms, and we avoid anything that will remind us about our own deaths. But the coronavirus pandemic has smashed these defense mechanisms, because we can't avoid the truth that just because we're human beings, we're desperately fragile and vulnerable. And at any moment, our own life or those of someone we love could be snuffed out by the virus. And a paper published in The Lancet last year reported the increased evidence of depression, anxiety, and stress related to the pandemic, health phobias, people binge-watching television and Netflix, increased alcohol consumption, increased calls to helplines, increased domestic abuse, self-harm, suicidal thoughts, and so on. And I think we all know there's also a marked rise in the time that we're spending just aimlessly surfing the web, obsessively playing pointless computer games, spending hours sifting through social media posts, binge-watching films and Netflix. Do you know the literal meaning of the word amusement is amuse, to stop thinking? Fill your mind with any old rubbish just so that you can stop thinking. Now, you might have thought that this epidemic of anxiety and depression and stress would be much less of a problem amongst those of us who are Christian believers. After all, we are the people who claim to believe in a loving and all-powerful God. And yet, all the evidence is that many of us who are Christians are also struggling with anxieties and fears and depression. So, fear and depression are a wake-up call for us that something is not right. If I'm finding that my mind is constantly preoccupied with worries, anxieties and fears, or if I'm struggling with black despair and suicidal thoughts and finding it's impossible to get myself motivated, these are not healthy emotions for everyday life. They're damaging and life-destroying. And Christians have often struggled with these things. I mean, including some very prominent Christians. Charles Spurgeon, very well-known Christian preacher and teacher, he was tortured by depression and anxiety throughout his life. And he wrote, "Though much of the evil lies in the imagination, it is not imaginary." So living each day with my mind churning and my heart racing because I'm thinking about the possibility of becoming infected or losing my job is not normal, and it should be a wake-up call. And so much of our anxieties come from dwelling and obsessing about the future, don't they? And Tim Keller summed it up like this: worriers are visionaries minus the optimism. I think it's a great quote. Worriers are visionaries minus the optimism. We think that by worrying and stressing about the future, we can somehow control it. And the truth is that we're all control freaks. We want complete control over this dangerous and frightening world so that we can know that we're safe and totally secure. And then we'll be able to relax. But the truth is, that's what Christians call idolatry. We've constructed an idol that we think will keep us safe. And then the coronavirus has come along and blown our illusions of control to smithereens. And our idols have failed. We're constantly reminded that nobody seems to be in control. It's pretty clear that politicians and the health experts and the epidemiologists are not in control. No one knows when there's going to be a new spike in infections. We all hope that the vaccines are going to make a difference and the world is going to return to normal soon, but we don't know. No one can predict what's going to happen to the economy, to our jobs, to our savings, to our children's education. Well, welcome to reality. We never were in control long before the pandemic struck. But our deep unspoken fears and worries are telling us something about ourselves. They're a wake-up call that something is wrong. Perhaps these emotions are saying more about us than about the pandemic. They show us what is most valuable to us and what we are most afraid of losing. So when everything seems to be falling apart, how do we get our heads around it? Is it possible to find meaning in the suffering? Viktor Frankl was a young Jewish psychiatrist at the time of the Second World War. He was put in the concentration camp in Auschwitz and went through appalling suffering. Somehow he survived, although most of the people he knew actually died in the camps. And out of his experiences, he wrote a well-known book, which is called Man's Search for Meaning. You can still get it, and it's worth reading. Viktor Frankl's conclusion was that a person could survive almost any degree of suffering and trauma, provided they could see some kind of meaning and purpose within the experience. And for him, what kept him going was the love of his wife and knowing that she loved him. It was that love which enabled him to survive the horrors of Auschwitz and keep on living. And he summarized his research in these words: those who have a why to live can bear with almost any how. Those who have a why to live can bear with almost any how. And I've had similar experiences on the neonatal unit, observing how parents cope with the psychological trauma of having a desperately sick newborn baby. So my first point is that human beings need meaning. We all need a narrative in which we can find ourselves and find some kind of purpose for our lives. And I think that's one of the reasons, the underlying reasons, why there's a steady rise in the amount of mental distress and mental health issues in our society. It's not just the virus. There's a loss of meaning. What we've discovered is even having a secure career and social status and economic security does not provide meaning. We need more than this. Of course, it's not the only reason for mental health problems, but that loss of meaning, I think, is one of the underlying causes. And then two, we need to be able to incorporate our own experiences of suffering and evil into a bigger story, into a bigger narrative. Because the truth is that all of us are going to be confronted by personal suffering and evil at some stage in our lives. And the question is, how are you going to make sense of that kind of suffering? It's interesting to me that in our modern technological society, we've lost the sense that there can be anything positive in pain, in struggle, in suffering, in difficulty. These are seen as entirely negative, destructive, meaningless. And the whole aim of technology and science is to avoid suffering, to make life easy, to maximize pleasure. That's the philosophy of the modern age. It was invented by a philosopher called Jeremy Bentham, who actually started my own university, UCL, in London. And he argued that the greatest good is happiness and the greatest evil is pain. And so we all have to live in a way that maximizes happiness and minimizes pain. It's interesting that there's just one area in modern life, in modern living, where pain seems to have an important value, and that's in the gym and the sports field. No pain, no gain. But in the rest of life, it seems, suffering is meaningless and totally negative, and it should be avoided and minimized at every turn. And if it happens to you, well, unlucky. But how does that philosophy match up when I see my loved ones dying or facing inexplicable suffering, or I face physical, mental, or spiritual anguish? Does it provide a framework for me to resist despair? And the interesting thing is that the Christian faith gives a much more complex and nuanced way of looking at suffering. It points to Jesus of Nazareth, who reveals a God of love, but also a God who enters into suffering, who takes it into his own life and being, a God who weeps and suffers with his creation. And one of the quotes which I found very helpful in my own medical work is that suffering is not a question which demands an answer. It's not a problem which demands a solution. It's a mystery which demands a presence. But from the perspective of the Christian faith, although suffering is an evil, good things can come out of it. To use the jargon, suffering can be redeemed. It can in some strange way get turned from blessing, from suffering turned into blessing and healing and personal growth. And that's my story as well, because I went through this a phase of a very severe psychiatric breakdown. I was, I'd become the most senior consultant on the neonatal unit. I was carrying an enormous load of clinical responsibilities and also leading a big research enterprise. And I hadn't had any previous psychological or psychiatric history, but then very rapidly over the space of a few weeks, I became acutely unwell and I started hallucinating. I was having weird stuff going on in my head. And I was admitted to an acute psychiatric unit. I had a number of weeks off work. I went back to work and then I had another second psychotic depression. And I ended up in a locked psychiatric ward. And at that point, I thought I was completely destroyed, completely wasted. I'd never again have any kind of professional work. I'd never again have any kind of Christian involvement. I thought I'd have to watch my family struggle with poverty and shame. And I'd have to spend the rest of my life just coming to terms with this complete and utter disaster. And at that time, if you'd talked to me about the love of God, it was completely meaningless. God was just a word with three letters. But the one thing that I discovered penetrated through to the absolute darkness was the sense that I was loved by human beings. I was loved by my wife, who came to visit me and gave me a cuddle in the ward, and a very close friend whom I'd known for years came to visit me. And a dear friend, a Christian leader, John Stott, tracked me down and telephoned me in the ward and said, "I appreciate your friendship, John." And that moved me to tears, and still does. That even in that terrible darkness, there were people who still loved me. I was reminded later on by the words of St. Bernard of Clairvaux, a spiritual writer of the medieval period, who wrote about spiritual friendship. And he said this: "Christ himself kisses us in the love of our friends." And I realized that that was true for me, that actually, in some strange way, God was reaching out to me through the person of my friends and my closest relatives. There are times of extreme loss and darkness when we're not able to access God's presence and reality in a direct manner, but we are able to experience his love in a physical form from our friends. Because we're physical beings, we need to hear physical voices. We need physical arms giving us a hug. We need the presence of caring human beings. And, you know, as I look back on that period of suffering and confusion, I realize that the process of healing and learning and growing that came out of that suffering has been incredibly valuable and enriching. It's given me new ways of understanding myself, new ways of understanding God's work in the world, new ways of helping and supporting other people with mental health issues. I wouldn't be talking about it now if I hadn't gone through that experience. And so many people, and myself included, would say that our lives have been strangely enriched by encounters with inexplicable evil. It's not that suffering is just eradicated and wiped away. No, it isn't. Far from it. And sometimes we're left, and I've been left with some permanent sort of scarring because of my psychiatric experiences. But in the encounter with suffering, something really strange and wonderful emerges. I can find some kind of meaning in the suffering. And I become convinced that there's nothing, however evil, however twisted, however malevolent, however apparently meaningless, which cannot in some sense be transformed by God and turned into blessing and healing. Yes, there is real evil, real pain, real suffering, and COVID is making the suffering so much more obvious, but it's not all meaningless. There's a bigger narrative. And perhaps that explains why so many people in our society who don't normally have anything to do with church have been attending online Christian services or events like this. There's a hunger to find something more meaningful than Netflix and Facebook and Angry Birds. So to come back to the words of Viktor Frankl, those who have a why to live can bear with almost any how. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, John. We have time for questions and answers. It's slido.com with the code QFL. In my original message, I managed to put slide.com, so apologies for that, or autocorrect there. I was wondering if I could just actually kick us off with, you said that God provides an actual meaning in suffering. But I know that many of my friends and folk in the Wharf actually would say that they can see some source of meaning in suffering, even perhaps without God. But they often articulate it in quite a vague sense. I was wondering if you could perhaps speak into where people look for meaning in suffering, and where they may be going wrong if they're not finding God in it.
Yeah, well, of course, wrestling with the issue of suffering is something that human beings have been doing for thousands of years. You can look back in the Bible to the book of Job, written hundreds of years before Christ, which shows, people wrestling with trying to find meaning and understanding. And the book of Job doesn't give any simple, slick, easy answers. There aren't any slick, simple, easy answers. But the sort of explanations which people tend to have come up with suffering is either that it's in the end just a sick joke, there isn't any meaning, and a lot of my colleagues at UCL, they would describe themselves as physicalists. They would say there's nothing really else in the world except physics, matter and energy, and basically, you get these random events, and sometimes, random events happen, and a virus emerges, and it happens to infect somebody, and they die, and it's just random, meaningless. Because it's very, very hard to really live your life with that sense that everything depends on these just utterly meaningless random events. It's interesting, a lot of people have some kind of deep sense about karma. I mean, in some of the Eastern religions, this is the fundamental idea, a law of cause and effect. And a lot of people think that, well, what goes around comes around. It's that kind of idea that there's some kind of meaningless, but some kind of impersonal mechanisms of karma that cause and effect, and good things happen to good people and bad things happen to bad people. What's unique, I think, about what Christianity has to say is that instead of saying that it's just something completely impersonal, it locates the source of suffering actually within a person. It doesn't explain why suffering happens, but astonishingly, when God reveals himself in the person of Jesus Christ, you would think, well, at last, God is going to come onto earth and he's going to give us some straightforward, simple answer about why suffering happens and why this person suffers and that person doesn't. Jesus doesn't give those simple answers. What's much more astonishing is that he enters into the suffering. He weeps with those who weep. And on the cross, he takes suffering and pain and agony into his own body. So Jesus reveals a God who is intimately involved in suffering, not someone who is distant. And therefore, that's, I think, what the unique thing that Christianity views is, instead of seeing suffering as something impersonal, it's something that we see in a person. And we have to understand it then through the eyes of a person from within. And that's why Jesus is the key that unlocks the meaning to our lives.
Thanks, John. And if suffering, were to be, if perhaps meaning in suffering were to be deceiving ourselves by kind of finding meaning in our suffering. This top question here asks just kind of what evidence is there that suffering is actually meaningful? Might we be deceiving ourselves by thinking it is?
Well, and of course the truth is yes, we're all capable of self-deception. And the problem is, when you're just locked inside your own head, It's very easy to develop your own sort of theories. And, you know, one of the famous quotes from G.K. Chesterton was that when people stop believing in God, they don't stop believing in nothing. They don't believe in nothing. They believe in anything. And that's a phenomenon in the modern world where, you know, all kinds of philosophies and ideas and explanations come around. So yes, each one of us, I think, has to try and find meaning. But it's trying to find a bigger narrative, it seems to me. You know, we are, as human beings, we are narrative-seeking beings. We're constantly looking, trying to find meaning. It's the way we're made. It's part of what it means to be human. And what Christianity offers is a grand narrative, a narrative which is much bigger than our own lives. What it says is that there's a huge drama that's going on, and it started before the foundation of the world, before the Big Bang, and it's going to go on into the future. And this narrative has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And then, even more astonishingly, what it says is that each one of us has a part written into this narrative. And the question is, are we going to find our place within that grand narrative? Now that's either self-delusion, some massive kind of bizarre corporate delusion, or it might just be true. And I happen to believe it is true that there is a great drama going on, and there's nothing single, nothing more important than to try to understand the nature of that grand drama and to see how I have been called to play a part in that. And that's the story of Jesus. That is the story. I mean, it's what theologians call salvation history, that there is a grand drama which has a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Thanks, John. And you said that it was God. Our next question is, you said that it was God reaching you through your friends and family. Is that not ungrateful to those who went out of their way to support you? So I think talking about in your kind of the darker moments that you shared.
Sure. And not, on the contrary, I mean, I'm immensely grateful for the love and practical and the people who went out of their way to make themselves show me practical love and caring. But these things can work at two levels, can't they? So that human love and human caring, we can see at the same time, is the way that God is reaching out to us. So God uses our human hands to reach out to others. So the two are not alternative explanations. They're both true at the same time. We care at a human level, but God uses us and speaks through us and speaks through human beings.
Great. And if suffering isn't resolved in our own lives, so I suppose I know that many a mental health issue never completely resolved, and people find themselves living with immense suffering for a very, very long time and perhaps don't see a hope beyond the suffering. How are we supposed to find meaning in that?
Well, sadly, it is true that often many people have a chronic mental health condition, and I don't think there's any fundamental difference between having a chronic physical condition like diabetes or cerebral palsy or Parkinson's disease or whatever it is, and having a chronic mental condition, mood disorder, depression, anxiety. I mean, both can cause immense suffering, and both don't have a quick sort of fix. It's something we learn to live with. But just in the same way that people who live with physical disabilities can actually learn to see how their lives can have meaning and significance despite the struggles, and sometimes through the very struggles of dealing with a physical disability. So in the same way, I have discovered that by having to wrestle at times with recurring psychological symptoms, It's a part of it. It's a chronic disability, but it's something that I can see how meaning can happen through it, and particularly how God can use us in our weakness. You know, because of my experiences of depression and anxiety and loss of meaning, I think I'm able to come alongside other people, and which wouldn't have been true if I'd never had those experiences. But yes, there's no quick, easy answer or easy solution, but I think we can see ways of living with this painful realities. And well known that in the Bible, the Apostle Paul, who was such an astonishingly effective ambassador for Christ in the early church, he had some kind of chronic condition, which he called his thorn in the flesh. And it's never clear exactly what it was, but it was clearly something that was very debilitating. And yet he said, rather than constantly try and resist and overcome this, he realized that he should actually glory in his weakness, that he should recognize that this was the reality of the life that had been given to him, and learn to live with the limitations.